Reading from Hebrews chapter 12, starting verse 18, on page 1009 in the Pew Bible. For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further message be spoken to them. For they would not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. But you have come to the Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to the innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. This phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken, that is, things that have been made, in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And thus let us offer to God acceptable worship, with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire.
Well, thanks, Rich, for reading. And can I add my welcome to Kev? It's great to see you. Welcome back if you've been away over the holidays or away for Christmas. And can I wish you a very happy new year? I wonder how the first 5 days of 2020 have been for you. January is quite well known, I think, for empty bank accounts and winter sick bugs, failed detox regimes and cravings for those things that you've given up because of your resolutions. Christmas is gone and you're back to work, and it's just sad, depressing winter days ahead. Still dark outside early, but without the Christmassy excitement to make it all feel magical. Very cheerful, isn't it? Apparently, most of us don't even bother making New Year's resolutions anymore, perhaps because over time we've become more and more cynical about our ability to keep them, and weary in trying to keep them. Easier, really, just to accept our post-Christmas extra weight and fitness level, and give in to the chocolate and the cheese that comforts our weary bodies. Well, last week, Callum reintroduced us to the book of Hebrews, and Christian readers who are feeling weary. If you look just up the page to verse 12 of chapter 12, their hands are drooping and their knees are weak. It felt to me last week like a very appropriate passage off the back of Christmas. And I wonder how weary you feel as you look ahead to another year trying to live by faith and not by sight. Waiting for God's promises. Another year probably marked by hardships. Maybe the scorn and mistreatment that comes from calling yourself a Christian, and probably marked by an ongoing struggle with sin. Those seem like the two big things that have come up in the book of Hebrews, the main threats to them giving up and drifting away and packing it all in, suffering and sin. And so they are weary. And the start of chapter 12 that we looked at last week was a real encouragement, actually, to see our hardships as purposeful, as a mark of God's love, as he shapes us to be more like Jesus, to be more holy. And the writer urged us on then in our struggle with sin. And it's in that context that he reminds us that hard work, even though the Christian life can be, we have something so much better than the old covenant. That's our first point today. We've come to something so much better than the old covenant. And you can see that the first half of our passage really is one big contrast between two mountains, two covenants. And the author's language there is really evocative. It's an assault on the senses to help us imagine it, to help us relive maybe the most powerful experience of God in the whole Old Testament, and then to compare that to what we have now. So we'll start off with the Exodus flashback in the first couple of verses. You might recognize it if you studied Exodus in midweek groups last year. It's a bit like watching Exodus 19 in one of those 4D cinemas. I don't know if you've ever been to one where they kind of spray water at you while you're watching and blow wind in your face. The author is trying to catch us up in the whirlwind of blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest, to feel what it was like for God's people at Mount Sinai when God declared his covenant to them. Just in case you don't know the story in Exodus, I'm going to read you some verses from the account there, Exodus 19. And I'd love you to imagine that you were there. Okay? So this is from Exodus 19. The Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments, and be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people, and you shall set limits for the people all round, saying, 'Take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot with arrows. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai." Can you imagine what it would be like to have been there? Or maybe imagine what it would be like if that happened today. So how would you have felt walking into church this evening if you noticed that the clouds had come low over Christ the King? The thunder was shaking the building and a huge fire was kind of raging maybe from here and up through the roof into the sky. How would you have felt? Well, obviously, when that happened to them, they were very scared. The swirling storm and fire, as the trumpet blasts louder and louder, and you stand before a mountain that you must not touch. Even if you're not afraid of the dark, I think the gloom and the tempest and the blazing fire would be enough to get you trembling in your boots. And scariest of all, did you notice? Is the voice which speaks through it all. A voice that Hebrews says caused the people to tremble and the mountain to tremble. And Moses, did you notice, the mediator? He trembles with fear. And they beg the voice to say no more because they cannot endure the order that is given. You could not fail to think, if you had been there, this is a fearsome God. I do not want to get on the wrong side of him. But, and perhaps verse 18 comes as a bit of a relief now that we look back at it, but we have not come to that. Verse 18, you have not come to what may be touched. We are not at Mount Sinai. Instead, verse 22, you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. And that's clearly not an earthly location, heavenly Jerusalem. It's not a mountain that you can touch yet. But it's obviously the mountain you would choose out of the two. So instead of the darkness and the cloud and the gloom and the tempest, this mountain has a city on it. And instead of safety fences guarding it, lest you die by touching it, we've come to innumerable angels in celebration. And the assembly of the firstborn, or the footnote says that could be the church of the firstborn, who are enrolled in heaven. On this mountain, in the city of the living God, there is a joyful celebration. And if you are a Christian here today, then your name is on the guest list. People can dwell there and not die. And interestingly, as the writer to the Hebrews records that event at Mount Sinai, the author, he doesn't name God. Did you notice? It was a terrifying encounter, but still they couldn't approach. Still, they can't actually see him. But verse 23, you have come to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood, which speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. The living God is so much more clearly revealed to us. The righteous are made perfect so that we might actually dwell with the judge of all. And all that obviously is possible through the new covenant that Jesus mediates for us. Our great high priest, sprinkling his own blood, poured out for you. Verse 24 might sound a bit weird. The blood speaks a better word. Well, the blood of Abel cried out for God in justice, that his murderer should face God's judgment. The blood of Jesus speaks forgiveness, that his murderers might be spared God's judgment. Two very different mountains, two different covenants. And these verses, which are packed with theological significance, which I think the author has actually been unpicking all the way through the book of Hebrews, they all are tied in together here in this glorious picture of the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. We are supposed to think that we have come to something so much better than the old covenant. It can't yet be touched. It's not as tangible, but it is infinitely more glorious. It's a better revelation of God, and it's accessible to people like us. And while the physical city is still to come, that'll be repeated again in chapter 13, he lists here massive privileges that are already yours, privileges that you have come to already. So the sprinkling of Jesus' blood at the cross means that you are already part of the heavenly celebrations. You are counted among the assembly of the firstborn. God, the judge of all, looks on you already as perfect. You are part of heavenly Jerusalem. And my tired, baby-sapped brain is still trying to work out the full significance of this, still trying to understand it. But if you have come to Jesus, then verses 22 to 24 describe what else you have come to as well. And that is crucial, actually, in order that we can understand then the logic of the second thing that the author is trying to teach us, our second point. And it's a bit of a Spider-Man moment, if you know the phrase, with great power comes great responsibility. This one is a slight tweak on that. With great privilege comes great responsibility. So the main reason that he reminds us of the first point is to warn us with the second. Since we have come to something so good, so much better than the old covenant, then we should be so much better at thankful, fearful worship. Because it is so good, then to refuse it now would be awful. So much worse. Responding rightly is even more important. Let me read again from verse 25. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. At that time, his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. This phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken, that is, things that have been made, in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And thus, let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Something more incredible has happened to you than the Sinai experience. Do you realize that? Then he warned them through Moses on earth, but now he has warned us from heaven. You might remember the opening line of the book of Hebrews. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. That's who is speaking there. God, through his Son's sprinkled blood, still speaking today, offering forgiveness today as the way to get into his city. Something more incredible is going to happen than happened at the Sinai experience as well. Then he shook the earth, and the people trembled, the mountain trembled. But there is a day coming when everything will tremble. And verse 27, it will be the removal of all created things, the things that have been made, so that only the things which cannot be shaken may remain. The Sinai experience was scary. You could not fail to think, this is a fearsome God. I don't want to get on the wrong side of him. And we might assume that under the new covenant, God is not fearsome anymore. That the Mount Zion God isn't as scary as the Mount Sinai God. And maybe this is that Old Testament, New Testament thing where God has changed somewhere in the middle, probably been tamed by Jesus. We don't need to be afraid anymore because God isn't dangerous anymore. Well, the logic of the passage, I think, takes us to the opposite conclusion. You should be even more aware that he is a fearsome God. Even more aware that you don't want to get on the wrong side of him. Verse 25, if they did not escape, much less will we escape. And it's also where we land at the end of the reading. So look down there again. Did you notice? Verse 28, therefore let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for, because, our God is a consuming fire. Reverence and awe aren't really words that we use very often anymore, I don't think. And I don't speak Greek, admittedly, but from what I can tell, both of those words could be translated fear. Let us offer to God acceptable worship with fear and fear, because our God is a consuming fire. God has not changed. He is still the blazing fire that they saw at Sinai. He's just as fearsome as he always has been. Fear him more than they did under the old covenant. And let that fuel your worship and your thankfulness. Next week, we'll unpack a little bit more what worship will actually look like. It seems to be something pervasive. It's every day and every situation and every relationship. But the way we should worship is reverence and awe, fear and fear, of the God who is a consuming fire and will yet once more carry out his judgment when he shakes not just the earth, but the entire cosmos. We've been following the news on the wildfires burning across Australia. Last time I checked the news, there were still 200 fires burning out of control. And over the past few months, they've destroyed something like 12.35 million acres of land, which is a bigger area than some European countries. Fran has family over there, and they told us about a man called Steve Harrison, who lives fairly close to them, and he left it too late to evacuate His garden and his driveway and the road outside, they were all on fire. And he had to hide. I think we've got a picture. He had to hide in this, a makeshift coffin-sized kiln that he made in the garden. He had to hide there for half an hour while the firestorm raged over him. Understandably, he was terrified. And not everyone has been as lucky as him to survive it. Other people who, like him, had planned to leave, but the fire had just come too quickly. In that context, you can't be flippant about consuming fire. The Sydney New Year's Eve fireworks this year were heavily criticised. I take it because people found it just too jarring to make entertainment out of fire when fire was destroying the lives and homes of so many people. Well, there is a day coming far worse than that and much scarier, when a consuming fire will shake the heavens and the earth. We should not be flippant about that. And on that day, there will be just one unshakable thing. If you are a Christian today, you've come to it already. Mount Zion, the city of the living God. You've been granted access to the only place of refuge. The only kingdom that will not be overthrown is God's. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And thus, let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Thankfulness and fear, probably two good questions to ask of your worship. Do you worship thankfully? Do you worship fearfully? Two characteristics, two disciplines, which I think would help us not to grow weary in the Christian life. Flippancy or presumption or entitlement or indifference, all of those will be very easily conquered by the temptations of sin. If you are not persuaded that you're better off under the new covenant, you'll find it so much harder to resist sin, to endure in the struggle, especially when sin offers you something that seems tangibly to make life better, easier, more pleasurable. But if you know that consuming fire is coming and there is only one chance of escape, you would not refuse God when he speaks to you. You'd lay aside, in fact, every weight and sin that clings so closely for the sake of your own survival. I'm convinced that thankfulness and fear will make me far less likely to grow weary, less likely to let my drooping hands give in to the pleasurable embrace of sin, less likely to let my weak knees take a rest by taking some time out of the race. Because what I've come to is so good and so vital for my survival that there is obvious madness to refusing it. It would be a bit like the man who has the kiln in his back garden to take refuge when the fire comes, but messes around in the house for too long because he's so attached to his home and his possessions. Or the person too busy enjoying the freedoms and pleasures of life to even listen to the news when they warn you that the fire is coming your way. Wouldn't you be mad? Because of where our passage comes in the book, it is the final warning to the wearied Christians in verses 12 to 17, who are thinking of just easing off in the struggle against sin. To keep running the race, but maybe just at a slower pace, with coffee breaks, and while pursuing other passions in life. To generally, on the whole, resist sin, while experimenting in some areas, just to see if God's boundaries are really right and really necessary. These verses show how dangerous that would be, to play with sin. Why would you ever refuse such a great salvation? And very typically, I think, of the book of Hebrews, you get the severe warning to make us cling gratefully, cling fearfully to the sure hope that you have. Not to be overconfident in ourselves in some way, but instead to anchor our assurance on the certainty of God's promises. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. That's where to put your confidence. And thus, offer acceptable worship with reverence and awe. Proper worship comes when you are driven by thankfulness and have a right view of our God, who is a consuming fire. I want to end with a quote. You'll probably have heard it before. It's from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And it's where the characters have just found out that Aslan is a lion. And I think it's Peter's reaction at the very end that I think would be exactly right for us. If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly. Then he isn't safe, said Lucy. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you. I'm longing to see him, said Peter, even if I do feel frightened when it comes to the point.